You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're on San Vicente Boulevard in Brentwood, and you spot something unusual, a homeless encampment. That's not the unusual part, sadly. What is unusual, though, is the way this encampment looks. The whole sidewalk is taken up by a line of identical tents. Big tents. And pinned to the outside of each one of those is an American flag. Now, this is right outside the West LA VA campus, the Veterans Administration campus. If you're not familiar with it, that is a huge gated property just west of the 405, a federally owned healthcare compound for military vets, run by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Many of LA's homeless veterans receive services there, so some folks actually stay on the sidewalk nearby. But this eye-catching encampment only popped up in the last few months.
It's a row of about 30 tents, and all the tents are supposed to be aligned. They're all supposed to have flags on the left-hand side.
Dean Lee is an Army veteran.
I served in 86 through 89 under Ronald Reagan, Bravo 529 Field Artillery in Fort Carson, Colorado.
He says PTSD from a sexual assault by another soldier led him to substance abuse and eventually homelessness. As chaotic as living on the streets is, Dean says this encampment has some military-style order.
We have standard operating procedures. We have fire guard. We have security watches. There's a lot of veterans that have a lot of different stories out here. Each one has their own individual story.
One thing that many share is the feeling that being a veteran and being homeless is, well, you know the saying, adding insult to injury. Yeah.
It really gets you down in your spirituality. After serving the country, and I'm not complaining. By all means, I have a gratitude list longer than a complaint list. But at the end of the day, you know, I did serve this country, and it hurts.
And for some of the veterans here, that hurt is coalesced around a cause. What they see is decades of negligence when it comes to housing homeless vets on the West LA VA campus. And in that respect, this encampment is meant to draw attention.
We're standing our ground as a peaceful protest.
But against what exactly? And why now? That story, it turns out, is only the latest development in a much bigger saga, one that involves a prime piece of L.A. real estate, a corruption scandal, a pandemic, and a plan to pick up the pieces. KCRW's Anna Scott takes it from here.
The story really begins 133 years ago, in 1887. Hey, we told you it was a saga. That year, a wealthy family donated the land that's now the VA campus with the stipulation that it had to serve as a home for military veterans. And for a long time, it did. At one point after the Korean War, between 4,000 and 5,000 veterans lived there. But by the 1970s, the VA started leasing out the property for all kinds of things. They maintained a hospital and other veteran services, but brought in a dog park, a UCLA baseball stadium, even a parrot sanctuary at one point. Meanwhile, many veterans lived on the streets.
You know, in the military, you never leave a fallen comrade behind on the battlefield. Why would we leave them behind here on American soil?
Bob Rosebrock is an Army veteran who lives in Brentwood, and every week for the past 12 years, he's protested outside the gates of the West LA VA. I met him there earlier this month.
Today is our 648th consecutive Sunday, and that's what we're trying to do, is to get housing for our veterans on the other side of that fence where they belong. It was legally deeded, and we've got veterans sleeping on the sidewalk here.
Now, Bob is not the only person to take on this issue. A decade ago, some homeless veterans sued VA officials over how the West LA campus was being used. Some of those non-veteran-related leases were deemed illegal and canceled. The parrot sanctuary is gone, for example. Later, it turned out there was a bribery scheme going on at the campus. Another VA official and a guy who ran private parking lots there were sentenced to prison. In short, it was a big, ugly mess. But from the fallout came a new vision for the property. 4 years ago, the VA unveiled a proposal to bring the campus back to its original mission and transform it into a community with more than 1,600 new apartments for homeless veterans. So, happy ending, right? Well, so far, only about 50 of those units are open. The next round of about 200 apartments is scheduled to open in 2022, and it'll be 10 years before the whole thing is done. Bob argues LA's homeless veterans need help now. He wants to see a huge triage site on the campus, tents, portable toilets, social services, enough to help all of the nearly 4,000 homeless veterans in LA County.
We've been asking forever on it, and really, we even sent President Obama a letter, a very respectful letter, saying we wanted emergency shelter inside and everything.
I've heard people say, well, we can just put up tents on the ground, but they're still homeless. They're living in a tent, but they're still homeless.
Stephen Peck is president and CEO of U.S. Vets, the country's biggest veterans services nonprofit. His organization is part of a team responsible for executing that grand new plan for the campus. Because the VA itself doesn't build housing, it's mostly a healthcare provider. It had to bring in developers and housing experts to actually finance and build all of this. That's one reason the plan is taking so long. Also, it's an enormous job.
The infrastructure is 50 or 60 years old. All of the buildings need to be renovated significantly. They were never residential. So it's a huge job, and the VA has never done this. So it's going to be a while, and no one's happy about that.
But it will be worth it, Stephen says, because in the end, it will provide enough permanent housing for almost half of LA County's homeless veterans. So that's where things stood until a few months ago. Enter the coronavirus and a new urgency to get people off the streets. In April, officials with the West LA VA did something that hadn't been done in Los Angeles for 40 years before that. They opened a tent city on the property with access to bathrooms, meals, and services. When Bob Rosebrock, the guy who protests every Sunday, heard about this, he thought, finally.
And first thing I did is I bought a 10 by 14 walk-in tent, took it to the VA, and they wrote back and said, no, we don't want your tent.
It was too big.
Only tent they would accept are these small pup tents. It's inhumane, and we can do better than that.
So Bob got some donors, ranging from his sister to the conservative activist group Judicial Watch, and they bought more than two dozen tents and American flags. One person who helped Bob deliver them was Robert Reynolds.
So at that time, we immediately set the tents up right outside the VA gate and started getting homeless veterans off the sidewalk and in somewhere to stay.
Robert is an Army veteran who served in Iraq. Combat left him with PTSD. A few years ago, he landed on San Vicente Boulevard himself. Now he's housed, but he comes back to this street most days to help other veterans. He views this encampment as an informal bridge between the streets and the programs on the VA campus, from substance abuse treatment to housing assistance.
We are currently trying to push people into the VA. That's our thing. We bring people here. We have a lot of guys that have gone in. We have had 45 guys go in that have come through this encampment out here. And we really pride ourselves on the fact that no longer will a homeless veteran arrive at the West LA VA and have to sleep on the sidewalk. They can at least get in a tent, get some food, and be around other veterans and have some, you know, positivity where we get them signed up and get them their services.
Robert also sees the encampment as a protest. He doesn't think the big plan for the VA property is enough. He wants to see the amount of housing on the land go back to its Korean War era peak.
We want this property returned back to its original capacity of 5,000.
Stephen Peck from U.S. Vets says the current plan is already the biggest project of its kind.
This is about three times bigger than anything else in the country. To do something three times bigger than that is kind of unimaginable.
But Stephen says he gets the mistrust among some homeless veterans and their advocates.
The West LA VA, I guess, made every mistake that they could. They were treating it like it was their property, not veterans' property. So there's a lot of residual anger out there, even with this new plan. I think it's understandable. At some point, they're going to have to let it go.
Over the next few weeks, the West LA VA plans to expand its tent program from about 50 to 100 people. They're also moving it from a couple of parking lots to a lawn with space for bigger tents. VA officials say they're doing outreach on San Vicente Boulevard to try and move eligible veterans there to the grass inside. So it's not the ideal scenario anyone imagined. People won't be moving into apartments yet, But soon, the West LA VA expects to house more veterans on its property than it has in years. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Well, moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA. With the U.S. Postal Service in seeming disarray, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a Republican mega donor appointed to that position this year by President Donald Trump, defended his management of the service earlier this morning in a hearing at the U.S. House of Representatives.
I'm very proud to lead the organization. The rest of your accusations are actually
Will you put the high-speed machines back?
No, I will not.
You will not.
Will not.
You will not. Well, there you go.
DeJoy has come under fire because of his handling of internal changes at the USPS, like getting rid of hundreds of sorting machines and reducing overtime for employees. Those changes have caused ripple effects nationwide, like a delay in getting your mail. Well, some local facilities are actually reporting accounts of dead animals, rotting food, and utter chaos. That's according to an investigation from the LA Times. Maya Lau is an investigative reporter there, and she's been covering this story with her colleague at the paper, Laura J. Nelson. Maya, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned in your reporting, Maya, that you found some facilities were in chaos. Tell us about the conditions. I guess you went from Tehachapi to South L.A. Talk about South L.A., which is a big distribution center, right?
Yeah, it's one of the largest distribution centers in the country. And, you know, we spoke to people who work there who said that things had really been piling up. Normally, you know, they would hear the sounds of baby chicks in boxes and they could see crickets jumping around, you know, being shipped to different places. And now they're just not hearing the sounds of the chicks anymore. And they're not seeing the crickets jumping around, and they can see that they're dead inside. And, you know, also experiencing where food is being shipped and is rotting and attracting flies. And there's even, you know, people who told us seeing rats run across the floor. And so the people who talked to us really said that this is, you know, above and beyond what they'd seen in the past, that just the mail is piling up in ways that it hadn't before. And I think that's reflected in the accounts from just thousands of people across the U.S. who've said their mail is delayed, their medications aren't getting to them, their paychecks aren't getting to them. And this is a delay that's, you know, above and beyond anything that they'd experienced in the past.
How are postal workers, so talk about the South LA facility where some sorting machines were taken out and things are, as you report, pretty much chaotic in those places. How are postal workers handling all of that?
I think they're overwhelmed. I think also when there was basically a practice put into place that they couldn't do overtime, that was really disruptive to the way that they do things. You know, they have had a practice of not leaving any mail behind. I think they took pride in that. At the end of the day, they always processed everything. And they're, you know, just even if it meant extra trips or even if it meant staying late. And so to not be able to work overtime was really disruptive to the way they did things. I think that some of that overtime has been restored now. But I think that it just caused a lot of chaos. And it seems like the plan was not well executed. Whatever the plan was to supposedly streamline things, it resulted in a bit of chaos.
Let's talk about the plan, because Postmaster DeJoy was put in that position this year. Is it the fact that, you know, is it a plan that had been longstanding? Is it something that just happened after he was installed as the Postmaster General? I mean, where did the plan come from?
I think that there's some confusion about that. DeJoy in his testimony has said repeatedly that the only changes that he made were reorganizing some people within the organization and also to make sure that all the trucks run on time. He says he didn't do anything about removing mailboxes. He didn't order the destruction or removal of mail sorting machines or the removal of overtime. So, you know, he's saying that it had been, you know, a longstanding discussion at the post office that they needed to streamline things because first class mail has been down. So I think that that is, you know, part of what people are trying to sort out. I've seen, you know, some reports that there were more expansive plans by him in place, or at least kind of in the works, to do some of the things that are happening. But I think that, you know, there's questions about, is this part of a sort of longstanding move in the direction of kind of, you know, downgrading on certain operations because of the change in mail traffic, you know, questions about how much of it is that and how much of it is a sort of sudden, more sudden things that have happened since he came in. You know, I think that from people we talked to, it does seem like all of this really ramped up in the past several weeks. And he did take office in mid-June.
It would be hard for us to talk about the Postal Service without bringing up mail-in ballots. We're in the middle of a pandemic. People across the country will be voting by mail as opposed to in person in higher numbers, certainly higher numbers than in years past. It's a big concern, those mail-in ballots, for voters who are worried that those ballots aren't going to make it in time because of the slow delivery, or maybe it will get lost mysteriously, things like that. The Postal Service actually warned California and most other states, I think 46 states total, that ballots might not be able to be delivered in time to be counted. When you were speaking to the folks at these facilities, was that a concern for them as well?
I think that they would still say that they are equipped to handle all the ballots that will come in. I think that it's more a concern of how things are changing overall at the post office. I mean, certainly they're concerned about mail-in voting, but the concern is that even with the suspension of some of these changes, as the Postmaster General said, you know, these changes would be suspended till after the election. That kind of alludes to the idea that the changes will resume after the election, and they are potentially ones that will impact, you know, when people are getting their prescriptions and paychecks and all of these things. So I think that individuals at the post office are still saying, you know, we can do this. Like we can deliver ballots on time, but we need support, and we need you know, machines to be in place, and we need to have, you know, certain mechanisms in place, because what's happening right now is causing a lot of chaos and confusion.
I know you're continuing to follow this story with your colleague Laura J. Nelson. Soliciting stories, anonymous stories from postal workers. Have you gotten any responses to your call out so far?
We have. Yeah, we've actually heard from a lot of people. I think this is something that's just so wide ranging. I mean, the post office is, you know, obviously something that we all use, and
it's in the Constitution.
Right. And I mean, so it's one of those stories where you actually are hearing from people so much, whether it's postal workers, whether it's people just who use the mail, whether it's truck drivers or, you know, independent contractors who contract with the USPS. We are hearing from a lot of people, but we always would like to hear more.
Well, it's certainly a story that a lot of folks are interested in, especially in an election year. Maya Lau, investigative reporter for the LA Times, her latest piece on the U.S. Postal Service is up now. Maya, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Giadakis. As the California COVID watch list goes, counties across the state want off. And now that is reality in the County of Orange. When coronavirus cases surged earlier this summer, the state included all counties in Southern California on a list. One that layered on extra restrictions for certain kinds of businesses until things got better. Well, the threshold to get off that watch list includes having fewer than 100 cases per 100,000 people and fewer than 8% of tests coming back positive. Orange County says they have hit those targets. Now, if they can keep case numbers below that magic number for a couple of weeks, many businesses and schools can reopen again. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He joins us here on Mondays with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Let's start here, because before we went into the weekend, Orange County was reporting 97 cases per 100,000 residents. That's under 100. And the state was reporting 183 cases per 100,000 residents, way above that threshold. So which one is right?
They're going to get together, both the health officers from Orange County and California, and try to figure out what the real rate is. And Governor Newsom last week, he talked about that. He said, look, there's been these discrepancies, but he's never seen it as a problem. He says, we just have to work it out because they have certain numbers and we have certain numbers. But of course, for the, you know, when it comes to Orange County and coronavirus, we know that especially the Board of Supervisors, this has been a body politic that has done everything possible to minimize the impact that coronavirus has had on Orange County. So a lot of skeptics are saying, why should we pay attention to whatever the county says? Just go with the state.
Do you think that there's been a change in the way they've looked at coronavirus, whether they've taken it more seriously, or is it still politicized and they're like, hey, we need to get back to living life?
Of course, they, for them, coronavirus was never a thing. The only problem for them is that it's just inconveniencing them come election time. You know, the person, I don't mean to pick on the person, but we're just reporting the facts that one supervisor who has gotten the most ire from people has been Michelle Steele, who's running for Congress. Infamously, in late April, when everybody was clamoring for the beaches to reopen, she said, the curve is flattening Orange County. Hospitalization rates are going down. Hence, we should open the beaches. We should basically not be on lockdown. That was in late April. Already, the campaign of Harley Ruda, the incoming congressman that Michelle is trying to go after, is using her own words to launch attack ads against her.
By the way, you know, the two different numbers notwithstanding, if the county can keep up a lowering of coronavirus numbers, what kinds of businesses will be allowed to reopen?
The one that everyone's paying attention to is the schools, because almost all schools in Orange County are doing distance learning. If after 15 days the positivity rates are low and we still are not back on the watch list, public schools in Orange County can open. Of course, that decision is going to be based on each individual school district. So it'll be interesting to see what parents are going to say, no, I still don't trust coronavirus. I still want to do distance learning. So these school districts are going to have to deal with all, you know, not just on a case-by-case basis, but on a child-by-child basis. If you think it's chaos now, just wait to see once we actually reopen again.
Well, let's talk about some other things besides the schools that could reopen if Orange County stays below that threshold. Are you talking about restaurants? I know we've been dining al fresco. I guess at a reduced capacity, will people be able to go out to eat again inside?
For this, the county has to go by what the state health standards are. And Governor Newsom has hinted that this week he's probably going to relax some of the shutdowns. For instance, right now, yes, you could dine al fresco outside, but you still can't go into a shopping mall. You still can't go inside of a gym. You still can't go inside of a hair salon. So maybe that's the next level of businesses that will be able to open. Now, you know, in hindsight, a lot of people say that the reason we had such a spike is because we reopened these businesses to go inside, and hence all these people started getting infected with coronavirus. So if you do it slowly but surely, then at the end, we're not going to have to do the same kind of shutdown that we had this past summer, or partial shutdown.
I mean, you and your wife own a business in Orange County. How's it been going for you guys? You know, are you guys suffering? What's going on with that?
Yeah, well, it's my wife is a sole owner. I am just a humble dishwasher and I make deliveries for people. Business has gone down a lot for her. But what has saved her is that she pivoted. She's now doing online sales. She has been able to, and she also has loyal customers. But yeah, no one can dine inside. And, you know, she has adjusted to our coronavirus reality in a way that I hope other restaurants are either doing or must understand that you have to do so, because coronavirus is not going anywhere, not for a couple of months, if not maybe a year or so.
Gustavo Arellano with this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
All right, so what about you? Do You think it's time to start slowly opening things back up in the OC? Is it too soon? Share your thoughts with us online at kcrw.com/ask Greater LA. And while you're there, what about subscribing to the podcast, too? You won't regret it, I promise. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, there are fewer of them these days, but California Republicans are hopeful. Some of them are participating in their big national convention this week and working to reelect the president. We're going to talk to one of them coming up. Jenna Cagle, Kaylee Wells, Sonia Geis, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Paul Smith, Jody Adler, Mike Newport, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen today. And Amy Ta, too. And special thanks to Jared Hill for filling in while I was away. I'm Steve Chitake. It's glad to be back. Thanks for your ears. Have a great day.